It's Wednesday, and normally I would now say we would cross over to the offices of El País to find out the week's Spanish news, but I'm actually going to go straight across the desk because Simon is with us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
It's a first.
It is. Well, I've been here with Dave before, but that was 3 years ago. But first time with you, we'll have no cats interrupting us, no noisy lorries reversing no, into me true, in the true. Courtyard at El País. We're just here in the relative calm of the TRE studios.
Fantastic. And you're here not because you decided you wanted to broadcast doing this, but that's quite a long way to come just for one broadcast. You're actually on holiday, aren't you?
I'm on holiday, and it's lovely. Yeah. So, but this is an added bonus to my holiday to pop in and see you guys.
Fantastic. Well, that's a good way to introduce the first topic, actually, because it is tourism in Spain, and how much more can we cope with?
Well, this is the thing. This is, for us, it's the story of the summer. I mean, we're really running a story about this pretty much every day.
Yeah.
So there's loads and loads to talk about. Really, the question is, one of the articles that we ran this week is just how much is too much? Because, I mean, you know, Spain's been battered by this economic crisis, and fortunately, it's had tourism to, you know, help it recover. Mm. And it's driving GDP. I think it accounts for something like 11% of GDP in Spain, not to mention 2.5 million jobs. But what we're seeing is this complete oversaturation of certain cities. Yeah. I mean, as the article pointed out, obviously, you know, it's not everywhere. You're never going to have too much tourism in somewhere like Teruel.
Sure.
But look at what's happening in Barcelona. Look at what's happening in the Balearic Islands. It's literally getting to the point where there aren't enough beds for the staff who are serving these tourists. So people are being priced out of the market. A lot of this is to do with Airbnb and these online platforms, because what these online platforms have done is enable your sort of regular Joe just to say, okay, well, I'm going to make a bit of money off my apartment, rent out their apartment. And of course, they're all demand-based systems. Yeah. So what happens is that locals are getting priced out of the market, and people that go to, you know, one of the great things about the tourism sector is it offers this, you know, bump in jobs at these peak time of the year, peak times of the year. But then what happens if you're a waiter? You go to the Balearics to work a season on one of the islands, but you've got nowhere to sleep. You literally can't find somewhere to sleep.
I watched this really interesting program called Inside Silicon Valley the other night, and it was about this particular episode was about Uber and Airbnb, and they had a big part of the Airbnb section where they went to Barcelona, where there were lots of demonstrations, and people had rented an Airbnb apartment just to demonstrate inside that they couldn't afford to stay in the city.
No, exactly. And the classic story is the woman that had to rent her own apartment on Airbnb and literally occupy it and change the locks because the person that she'd rented it to had decided to start renting it out on Airbnb. And this is the kind of stuff that's happening. So what do the local authorities do? But in Barcelona, we've got this former social activist mayor called Ada Colau, and Barcelona is one of the focal points of all of this problem. And she's taking action. I mean, they're talking about limiting the numbers of beds. They're also talking about limiting the number of cruise ships that come and stop, because this is another thing. In cities like Barcelona, which are visited like cruise ships, a bit like Venice, you know, what happens is these cruise ships arrive, they disgorge all of these passengers. Yeah. They wander around the city. They, you know, crowd out the streets. Don't necessarily spend much money and then get back on and disappear again. Even in Galicia, on the Santiago, the St. James Way, you know, the pilgrimage route, the famous pilgrimage route, they're complaining in Galicia because people walking the route are coming along and maybe just ordering like one plate of food between the three of them. So it's, again, it's this thing about quality tourism versus quantity, and it's really presenting Spain with this massive quandary. 80 million foreign visitors estimated for 2017. I mean, it's a record. You know, Spain just keeps beating its own records in terms of tourism, helped obviously by the situation in other countries, the security situation in certain Middle Eastern destinations where people would normally go. But, you know, some of the experts are saying that taking measures, it's not necessarily going to help. If you crack down on Airbnb, then someone will set up another platform. Mm. There'll be another thing that, you know, so people will be able to...
It's like that game where the things pop up and you hit them with a hammer and another one pops
Whack-a-mole.
up.
Whack-a-mole. whack-a-mole. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, what do they do? And it's the infrastructure as well. I mean, you're even talking about that. I invite your readers to go and check out this story that we published on Friday from the Sunday magazine, from El País Semanal. And basically we're saying that it's not just the you know, lack of beds, but it's even things like the infrastructure can't cope with it.
Roads, particularly. I mean, certainly in this area of the world, the roads are pretty good, and most of the year you think this is it's actually a joy, apart from the drivers, to drive in Spain because the roads are so good. But then you get the summer, and the roads were never designed to carry that much traffic, and the slip roads onto them never designed to have that much traffic coming onto them, and everybody just gets very grumpy and very upset, and it's just it's like driving around central London, which is really bizarre.
Bill Madrid. That's what. That's what Madrid is like all year round, I'm sorry to say.
Right.
Which is why I try to cycle to work as much as possible. But yeah.
But what can be done? Because you can't tell them all to go back home again, can you?
No, exactly. But what you can do is you can put caps on the amount of beds that are offered. You can also raise the prices. This is the other thing. You can start hiking prices so that maybe these destinations aren't so sort of, you know, cheap and cheerful and attract people in such massive numbers. But it's very, very tough because obviously the businesses that benefit from this and the people that are working in this sector, they don't necessarily want anything to happen. But
sure.
I think after this year, if this continues next year, if the numbers keep growing, then we're going to be facing some pretty serious problems.
It becomes a law of diminishing return then, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because the people that do come here are fed up because they can't get anywhere, they can't do anything. It's just carnage.
Exactly, and it's a question of quality of life for the people that live there all the year round.
Yeah, interesting. And then, of course, we've got the whole new problem, and there was a big documentary on this on Panorama on Monday about air travel, and in particular they singled out, unfortunately, Ibiza, Mallorca and Alicante as the three destinations in Europe where people were basically getting drunk as skunks before they boarded the plane and causing all kinds of grief, and then getting either diverted because they were too drunk or having a fight on the plane, or arrested the second they arrive in Mallorca.
Definitely. I saw an article about that the other day, and it was a former cabin crew member saying that, you know, people should not be allowed to drink. They shouldn't be allowed to take on their own booze, drink their own booze on the plane, because you can't control that, and they shouldn't be served alcohol with breakfast, which almost seems to go without saying, doesn't it?
It does. A guy from Jet2 was interviewed, and the managing director of Jet2, and he said, "Well, we've done something about it. We're not serving alcohol before 8 a.m. on
flight." Well, there you go.
But of course, selling alcohol makes flights ultimately cheaper, and so there is a kind of the airlines were quite quiet about the whole thing, but they did speak to the woman who was running the kind of British airports, and she was saying, "I can't see the problem. We're talking about this and it's all fine." And in behind her, you know, there are people like falling over, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning because they've had too much to drink already.
Well, it's that typical thing. You wouldn't want to, you know, don't spoil it for everyone else. I like to have a glass of wine or a little gin tonic on a flight. Don't want to have to miss out on that privilege.
Exactly. Okay. Why Spain is more than just ham and beer. And this is American residents' impressions of the country.
This is one of those stories that you publish the story and then the story itself takes on a life of its own, and this goes back three years, and this American young girl who was studying, I think she was studying in Spain, and she wrote this blog post about how much living in a small Spanish village had changed her for the better, and, you know, what a positive experience it had been. And the thing went viral, and so the El País picked it up and translated it and ran it in Spanish. And I think at that point we ran it in English as well. Now, 3 years later, this girl, whose name is Casey Tenin, she's just about to move back to the US. So she's written another article. It was entitled, "I'm from New York and my life has changed from spending 3 years in Spain." So kind of along the similar route. Okay. And she's sort of talking about how she'd lived in Madrid, in Granada, and Fregenal de la Sierra, which is this small rural town in Extremadura. And she was talking about how, you know, what a positive effect Spain had had on it. Now, just as a footnote, I should mention that we then wanted to run this latest blog post in English, because we'd run it in Spanish, and we wanted to run it in English, but she wanted more money for us to run it in English. So obviously, that's just one of the ways that living in Spain had changed her.
She's love it.
A bit more savvy about when it comes to finances. But anyway, she was incredibly positive about her experience. She said, "I'm constantly amazed at the generosity with which people share their lives, their time, their things and their food. I've been taught what it means to share without expecting anything in return besides company," which is really, really nice, because it's an experience that a lot of us have had. I mean, I've spoken to you lots of times about going to, you know, my wife's family's village and the way that people receive you and the way that, you know, that thing of like eat and they just, you know, ply you with food and that kind of thing, which is just fantastic. But then what happened was, you know, this is the thing. One thing I've learned in journalism: never read the comments underneath an article.
it's like reading reviews. If you've done something and somebody's reviewed it, never read the reviews either.
Don't do it. My wife wrote an article for our pies once about what we were feeding our 6-month-old baby. Yeah. And the top comment was, why do I care what you feed your baby? And it's like, well, why would you read an article about what we feed our baby and then take the time to write a comment underneath it?
Because here comes the
backlash. People were saying that there's more to Spain than Spanish omelette, than ham and beer. And others came up with these quite interesting comments. And some of these were from Spanish people and some of these were from foreigners. And I think it's quite interesting because they ran this in the Spanish version of El País. So it's kind of interesting for Spanish people to see not just, you know, expats going, "Oh, well, that's wonderful," but actually to come up with some sort of fairly genuine criticisms. So these include like the absurd working hours, you know, which is something that we've spoken about before.
Yep. Yep.
You've got these crazy working hours, these really long days with the, you know, the 2-hour
or really short days.
It depends. Talking about how people are snobs. One poster said, "If this girl didn't come from New York but a Latin American country, people wouldn't have approached her," which is why I find that really interesting. I think in general, Spain is not at all a racist country, but it's interesting that people would point out and say, well, is there maybe a difference in terms of the way people are treated from North America and the way that people are treated from South America and Latin America? And then another American who's got a Spanish husband, she wrote into El País and she came up with some really interesting comments. She said that life is definitely better in Spain than in the US, but she's leaving Spain for a job opportunity that will be unimaginable here. And one of our most popular articles of all time is headlined, "Spain, great place to live, terrible place to work." And every time we repost that, it pops back into our top 10, because I think so many people find that while the standard of living here is just amazing, it can be really, really hard to make it work. I mean, where we are now, it's different, you know, or in somewhere like Barcelona, it's different. But if you're even in Madrid, it can be very hard. I mean, I can count on the fingers of one hand the amount of people that I know from, you know, when I first moved here 17 years ago, who are still here, because people tend to pretend to leave, you know, because they just can't make it work. They can't make it work with their jobs. And then there's the, you know, again, this girl that wrote in, she mentioned the thing about the timetables, that sleeping and really late, movies don't start on the TV, on Spanish TV, until 10 p.m. You know, something like that. I think it was MasterChef recently.
Right.
The final was on a weeknight. And it didn't finish until 2 a.m. on a weeknight. It's insane. It was like 3 hours long and it didn't finish until about 1:30, 2 a.m, which is crazy. And then she came up with this other one, which I really like, which was another Spanish trait she had difficulty adapting to was the constant gossip. One day, Molly was about to leave her house wearing yoga pants until her husband stopped her and asked where she was going dressed like that. Because the neighbours would speak. And then the original poster of the article, Casey Tenin, she wrote in to kind of clarify some of the things that she was talking about and also kind of come up with some of her sort of more negative points, which is where this is my favourite one. "In Spain, you might encounter a group of old women blocking a sidewalk." That's one of my favourites.
First world problems.
But that is true, though. And the person in front of you in the grocery line might spend 15 minutes chatting with the grocer or the butcher. That is a classic. I cannot go. I go to a supermarket, or if it's the weekend and I've got nothing else to do, then I'll go to the butcher's and I'll stand there chatting with the butcher. Because otherwise, forget about it. You'll be in there all day.
One of my favourites is the speed in a supermarket with which things are passed from the cashier back to you to pack. It's impossible to pack in Spain into bags because they're coming so fast at you that you can't do it.
I'm a huge fan of Mercadona, but I do think that Mercadona should put packers. You get have a specific person to help you bag your groceries. It would be pretty, it would make it the perfect supermarket.
Fantastic. Funny you say that about Mercadona. One of the first weeks I was here, and other supermarkets, by the way, are available. Yeah. One of the first weeks I was here, you know, they had the little jingle in Mercadona, and then they would play little bits of music. And literally, the first week I was here, we're walking through Mercadona, and on came this track. I went, blind, they're playing one of my songs. Oh my God, they're playing one of my songs. And they played it for like 15 seconds and someone went, ugh, and moved on to another one. Welcome to Spain.
Definitely.
Finally, the unwritten rules of Spanish villages. How to not upset the locals.
Exactly. Now, this is, you can tell it's August and I've brought some particularly sort of silly season stories here. But yeah, this is great. So we're talking about, everyone knows these Spanish villages when you kind of, you know, you drive in and there's a group of old people with sticks and hats on sitting around the fountain or bike. Do you know what I mean? Or sitting out on their stoops, or there's an old lady bent down and she's kind of scrubbing her front step. So these are the unwritten rules of these villages. Parking is prohibited in places where people hang out outdoors. So never go anywhere near one of these kind of, you know, places where people are on their benches. You just, you know,
where the
neighbours set up their chairs to enjoy the fresh air at night. Cars do not have priority ever. In fact, in my wife's village, it's more the cows that have the priority and the sheep, which you'll just hear this distant sort of like tinkling of bells, and then all of a sudden this kind of massive herd of animals will come through. You must be able to locate all neighbours in an extended kinship system. So someone will tell you about Juan, the son of El Mochuelo, before they can continue, and you must immediately interject, yes, he married Isabella from the fruit shop. So you need to know this extended sort of family tree. You have to say hello, not to everyone, but to almost everyone. And a simple ¿qué tal? Is not enough. You have to say how you're doing, in addition to talking about your entire family.
And what about kissing? Is kissing mandatory?
Kissing is mandatory. If anyone's ever seen the Pedro Almodóvar film Volver, there's a very big thing about kissing, that very kind of noisy... It's just this thing that a certain aged Spanish lady can do perfectly. It's this kind of like multiple very noisy kisses on each cheek.
But if you're faced with, let's say you walk in and there's a family or a group of friends or whatever, and you're introducing them for the first time.
Oh, you have to kiss everyone.
I mean, seven or eight of them, for God's sake. You know, by the time you've gone in there, you've got some kind of disease by the time you've gone.
I went to a family party with my wife years ago in London, and it was a, you know, big extended family was there. We kind of knew. We didn't know. And I always find it really hard, after so long living in Spain, I find it really hard to know what to do in that situation in the UK. Do you shake the hand? Do you kiss? What do you do? And so I kind of kissed, I think I kissed someone, and then I sort of shook someone's hand, and then I looked down the line and there were all these kids and they were just looking at me like terrified. Like, what's he going to do to me? So I was like, okay, well, I think I'll just wave and sort of say hello to everyone.
I love it.
So at least you know where you are in Spain. You know, you kiss and you shake hands. And, but, you know, it's complicated.
Yes.
And now, next rule. The elderly can always criticise your appearance. A bit going back to the yoga pants, really. And you don't have the right to respond. True villagers are born in the village. Everyone else is a foreigner. You have to find the areas with a decent cell phone signal. Now, I can attest to this in my wife's family's house. You have to go upstairs and put your phone in the window. Otherwise, you are completely screwed. It's not going to happen. And you can leave the door open. This is the bit that I particularly like. You know, you leave the key in the front door because no one's going to... Who's going to rob you if you know everyone in there?
Yeah.
So that's always really nice, especially coming from Madrid where you have to, you know, watch your belongings like a hawk.
Yeah.
And this one's a good one. If you live outside your village, you must always take days off to return for the fiestas. And we certainly do that. And we get this mad day. And the last day of the fiestas is a Sunday. And at 11 o'clock in the morning, one of those little kind of bands, you know, with a drum and a clarinet, whatever, it will start leading all the villagers round the village. And you just basically go from house to house eating black pudding in every single house and drinking wine. And it starts at about 11. It finishes about 3. And everyone by the end of the day is a mess. They call it La Diana. I don't know why they call it the Diana, but it's a lovely, lovely tradition. And this last one, if you live outside your village, rivalries with the surrounding villages must be maintained.
Oh, really?
Yes, exactly. Even if you, it doesn't matter if you, no, exactly, it's that thing. You can go to the fiestas and you have a good, great time, but you must keep up the hostilities.
Oh, what an insight into village life. Fantastic time. Now, we are going to keep you on because yes. I just thought that now we've got you here, I'd just like to know a little bit about what you do. So we'll play a record here and after the break, and we'll have a little bit of chat about what it's like to be a journalist at a big, proper newspaper Fantastic. Here in Spain, because it's an interesting job.
Definitely.
All right, back in a sec. So a little departure from our usual kind of Wednesday chat, because we've got Simon Hunter here from El País, who's here on holiday, and we've just done our kind of our obligatory El País news bit. But I just thought it'd be nice now you're here to kind of have a gas about you, because you've been here a while, right, in Spain?
Yeah, I moved out here in the year 2000, basically. I came to visit Madrid when I was still at university. A friend of mine was doing her Erasmus year in Madrid, and I went out to visit her. I spent a week there, and it just blew my mind. I just completely fell in love with it. And I had no plans finishing university. I wanted to go and live abroad for a while, and it was that typical thing. It was like, well, I'll just go, you know, I'll go and try it for 6 months. And then 17 and a half years later, wow. I married to a Spaniard with a job and a mortgage and a kid and another wow. kid on the way, and just, you know, that typical thing where a place just gets its hooks into you and you don't want to leave.
And I would imagine that things have changed a little bit in 17 and a half years.
Yeah, they really have. I mean, it's been amazing. I mean, the thing about Madrid that I've always found is that it's still a very Spanish city. It's a big city, but yeah. it's a very Spanish city. Now, that is changing, and it's changed a huge amount in just this short time for lots of different reasons. I mean, obviously, you know, onward march of globalization, you see more things like McDonald's and Subway and, you know, things like that springing up. But there's been other things that have changed in the city, such as, for example, the end of what they call renta antigua, which is this system where certain establishments had their rent frozen. So, you know, you had this, you know, this family restaurant that had been there for 50 years that was paying about 20 euros in rent a month or some absurd amount. Yeah. And obviously, as that's come to an end, as the law has changed and that's come to an end, a lot of these places haven't survived. So a lot of the sort of, you know, spit and sawdust bars, you know, a lot of the old classic places have all have closed up and have moved on. But that said, I mean, there's still, it's, you know, you compare it to Barcelona, and I think the thing that people find about Madrid is that it is still very, very Spanish. And that's, you know, one of the great appeals for me. Plus, you know, all the old cliches like the food and all that kind of stuff, and just the quality of life. I mean, where we live, you know, we've got in our apartment building, we've got a creche and a bar, which is all we need, really.
Amazing.
Take kid to creche, go to bar. I mean, it's pretty pretty simple as that. So we very, very rarely kind of stray away from our neighbourhood.
But that's kind of indicative of the Spanish thing that families are so important here.
Exactly, yeah. We live a 10-minute walk away from my in-laws. They look after Matty, you know, most of the day. The childcare here is cheap. I mean, you know, I have a friend in the UK, and she's spending about nearly £2,000 a month on looking after her kids, and our creche, you know, our childcare is about 400 euros a month. So
how incredible.
Yeah, it really is. So I mean, for quality of life, I don't think you really can't go wrong in Spain. As we mentioned when we were just having the chat just now, you know, it's I don't know if it's changing. It's difficult to say, but definitely the work side is difficult. It's hard to find good work. It's hard to find something that, you know, you can be happy with. It's tricky, especially in something like journalism. There's not a huge amount of jobs around in journalism. Sure. But having said that, you know, you get this fantastic quality of life. So, you know, it's all you've got to weigh it up. You've got to evaluate it.
And living in Madrid, where were you in the UK?
Where was I? Where am I from in the UK? Yeah. I'm from Essex originally. My parents live.
You're an Essex boy.
I'm an Essex boy. Yeah.
That explains a lot.
Please don't hold that against.
So I mean, if you were to compare kind of Madrid with London, you know, is it as mad as London to live in?
No, definitely not. No, it's not as big. I mean, it's I've always said it's a village-sized city. When I first moved there and I was teaching English, just used to walk everywhere. It was fantastic. I don't think I've ever been thinner. Just like walking everywhere or getting the metro everywhere. It's not as sprawling as London. It's also, you know, it's a nocturnal city. It's not like London where you kind of, you know, if you if you miss the last, metro train, you're completely lost.
I mean, also, in fact, have you said that? We just had an email here from Jeff in Torrevieja who says, Spanish time. Huh, the kickoff time for tonight's second leg of the Supercopa Real Madrid versus Barca is not until 11 p.m.
Oh, that's the thing. I mean, but you just have to completely change your timetables and your way of doing things. I mean, in my case, you know, because I have a Spanish family, so but you have to do it. We were in my wife's village one time, and a lot of her family were there, and we were watching a really late night football game, and I don't think it finished until past midnight. And I was sort of sitting there thinking, this is a bit weird. We haven't actually had dinner yet. This is kind of strange.
Goodness.
And then the game finished at 12:30, and literally my wife's aunt got up and started cutting up chorizo and satichan. And we all sat there and we had dinner at nearly 1 o'clock in the
good
morning.
Good grief. I'm
just trying to see if my wife's going to react. She's sitting across the glass.
Hello!
When did I say something really outrageous? Yeah. And see if she turns
out. You make it sound like, you know, kind of this tiny, tiny village in the middle of nowhere where you're missing this from.
It really is. It's called Voz Mediano. It's in León. It's near a town called Boñar. And it literally is at the end of a road. So no one ever passes through there. The only thing that you might see when we're celebrating the fiestas, which is always, and it happened again this year, and I love it when this happens, is you might get mountain bikers. So as I was just explaining when we were doing the news, we do this thing on the Sunday called the La Diana, which is where everyone goes from house to house from 11
o'clock
in the morning.
Sausages and black pudding and alcohol.
Pudding and alcohol, basically. And by 3 o'clock, everyone's a mess. But by about 3 o'clock, we're normally up the other end of the village. And normally, always, every year, a couple of cyclists come past and they just kind of are met with this sight of these wine-soaked people with wigs on and playing kazoos and they always obligatory they have to drink some wine as they go past on their mountain bikes, and there's some serious hills there, so I don't know how that must sit on their stomachs. But
how quickly did you kind of learn the language and fit in?
I went very quickly because my first journalistic job in inverted commas was writing nightlife guides in Madrid. I got very much into the clubbing scene. It's the tail end of the 90s, and it was still very a vibrant scene. There was loads and loads of after hours clubs which would like open their doors at 6 o'clock in the morning, and for me it was just like, what is this? This is crazy. So I got very much into that scene, and I started writing nightclub guides, bar guides and stuff for a local magazine. And I found, you know, because that was, you were in the kind of an environment, you know, you know how easy it is to convince yourself you're a linguist expert after a couple of beers. So that meant that I picked up very quickly. And by the end of the 6 months, I could, you know, pretty much hold a conversation. Right. And then just, you know, just went on from there. I think my Spanish probably peaked in about 2004 when I was actually working in Spanish, when I was working all day, because that makes a huge difference. Now, obviously, I use Spanish from time to time in the office, but mostly I'm speaking to my colleagues in English, obviously, because we're a team of Brits. And at home. But you've got to practice, and you've got to not be afraid of making mistakes. Because when you make a mistake and you say something stupid and someone laughs at you, you'll never make that mistake again. Mm. I said the other day in the newsroom, I said to the woman who runs the social networking department, I wanted to say, you've dropped your scarf. I actually said to her, you've dropped your nappy. And that was like literally, you know, that was a week ago. So I'm still making those stupid mistakes. But once you make a mistake like that once, you won't make it again.
It's very funny. When I was living in Thailand for a while, I thought not bad at Thai. And I had a flu one day, a fever. And I was fed up saying, oh, I've got a cold. And they tell me, how can you have a cold? Because it's really hot. And I'm, no, it's not a cold. It's a fever. And so I learned the Thai word for I have a fever. So I thought. So first person that said, how are you? I said in Thai, my best Thai, I have a fever. And they burst out laughing. And I said, but it's not funny. I said, I don't really feel that well. She said, no. You meant to say, I have a fever. You actually said, I have testicles.
It was true,
but not what I wanted to say. So, El País, it's a proper paper, right?
It's a proper paper.
And you've been there a while now. I was, you know, when I came here at first, I was amazed by the amount of newspapers there were. There seemed to be hundreds and hundreds of newspapers. Mm. But El País has always been regarded as you know, it's a proper newspaper. Mm. How did you get into there?
Well, when the nightclub reviews for this magazine led to an editorship of that magazine. Right. So I did that for 2 years. And then after 2 years, a job opportunity came up via our dear departed friend, Martin Delphine, formerly of this parish, who used to come on and speak and who very tragically passed away last year. He was already working at El País and he found there was a job opportunity. So he told me about it. So I went along and got the job, and I've been there ever since. I've been there 11 years. Wow. I mean, I don't just work at El País. I do lots of other stuff as well. You know, anything from guidebooks to, you know, writing stuff in newspapers or for in-flight magazines. I do voiceover work and stuff like that. But El País has always been like my main thing. And it's been really, really interesting because basically it's been, you know, watching the transformation of a traditional print medium to a primarily digital media outlet. And last year we had this big meeting, we were all called to this big meeting in the printing press because the printing press is still, we're still on the same site we've been for 40 years. Wow. The printing press is right next door. And the editor-in-chief, a man called Antonio Caño, he called us all up and obviously it was just a kind of, I guess, a symbolic place to hold this meeting, but to say, look, you know, from now on we are digital first and we will keep printing a physical newspaper while we can, but that won't be forever and it's not going to be viable forever. And I mean, you know, the only thing I've ever wanted to do is to work at a newspaper. And I used to love newspapers. Mm. You know, when I used to go and work in London in my summer holidays, I could do the thing with the folding, the broadsheet, the origami, and, you know, without bothering the passenger next to you on the train. Yeah. But now I had to be honest, now I pick up one of those and I'm like, oh, this is awful. I've got print all over my fingers and it's unwieldy. And you're reading yesterday's news. So, you know, newspapers these days, printed newspapers have to be offering something that you can't find on the web. So it has to be the kind of sort of analysis and comment and opinion that you're going to want to read. Because if you're, you know, the average person now, you're reading stuff on your smartphone.
Yeah.
What was really interesting was when El País did a big redesign last year and they took out the full TV listings in the printed newspaper, and there was a huge outcry from the readers because of course the demographic of the
printed version.
Yeah, the printed version is someone who doesn't have a smartphone. It's probably someone who's a senior or a pensioner and is relying on that newspaper to find out what's on the TV. They're not watching Netflix. They're not watching streaming services. You know, they want to know what's on the TV and when. So we had to put it back in, of course, you know, to keep that reader happy.
But I imagine when that meeting happened, and the fateful day arrived, that some of the kind of older journalists, for them, that must have been almost like saying, well, basically, we're going to put you down, you know?
Yeah, it's been very, very tricky. A lot of the veteran journalists have been very upset by, you know, certain comments and trends towards things like, you know, Twitter and the interest in, you know, how many Twitter users the journalists have got. And that's been very tough. And also just in terms of, you know, the way that people deal with their stories. You know, it used to be that the story that the journalist would be most interested in working on during the day would be the print version. But now it has to be the other way around. It's like, get it on the internet and get it up there as quickly as possible, and then we'll go back and look at the print version.
And I guess your newsroom now is the Starship Enterprise, I would have thought.
It really is, yeah. There's this, it literally is like the bridge. I always say it's the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. There's a desk, a circular desk that kind of overlooks the main hub of the newsroom, which is where the bosses sit. it's right in front of this massive video wall where you can see all of the headlines of all the different media all over the world, but also you can see in real time how many people are on the El País front page and how many people are in a given story, how much time they're spending in that story. So there's all this kind of qualitative and quantitative analysis now of what's going on the web. It's amazing. It's changed so much.
Wow. And in terms of your daily job, I guess before, when you started, I mean, you were using a computer, but now I guess you're kind of tapping away on your iPhone occasionally and sending stuff, and it's just changed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, now I can literally do, I mean, I could, you know, I could update our front page from here, you know, with my smartphone and with my laptop, which obviously, you know, before we were working a 4 p.m. to a 9 p.m. schedule, you know, closing the print edition at 9, and that was it, and you closed it and then you went away. But now obviously it's a constant thing. But yeah, I mean, I have to say, for all the romanticism there is about print and how much I used to love print newspapers, I mean, it's so much more interesting now. And also, if you make a mistake now, you can go and change it straight away.
Very good.
Which is great.
Yeah. I've been joined by Mr. Dave Hodgson. Good afternoon.
Good morning, Mr. Bill Padley and Dave, Simon. It's this great reunion.
It's been 3 years.
He used to be on my show till someone poached him.
Yeah, he'll be posted again. Yeah. We actually offered him more money. It was easy, Dave. Yeah. Really
money? All right, you're getting money now.
Money?
All right.
I'll clip my briefcase on the way out.
Fantastic. Well, how do you cope these days as a proper journalist who's writing news every single day of your life with the current kind of fake news thing? You know, that everything on the internet is made up.
Yeah, well, it's what I was saying to you before. It's don't read the comments. The best thing is to not read the comments, because it's unbelievable how quickly now people will just write fake news to a story that they don't like. I mean, it's not that it's not true. Or people quite often will question why we're reporting on something, which I find that really interesting. It's as if it's almost our fault that something is happening, you know, because we are reporting on it. Whereas it's really the other way around. We're reporting on something because it's happening.
I was just going to ask you, along those lines, we know that El País leans slightly, and certain newspapers lean, so El Mundo would be probably right, a bit more right. So are you ever told you're not allowed to write that, or you've got to write this?
I've never been told not to write something, no. I mean, but obviously what we do, you have to, I mean, let's make clear what we do. Yeah. We're not reporters. What we do is we take the Spanish news and we do an English version of it. We don't just translate the story straight, but what we do is we will add more context, we'll change the headline, we'll make it appropriate for a foreign audience. But no, I mean, I've never seen... you know, orders come down from on high in an editorial meeting to say, no, you know, this is not how it's going to go. I think with El País, you can almost be sure that what you're getting is a very fair representation of the news. If you look at something like El Mundo, when the previous editor was there, Pedro Jota, they call him, he was a very controversial figure, and that newspaper perpetuated a lot of conspiracy theories about the Atocha train bombings, for example, about the involvement of the Basque terrorist group ETA. And fortunately, El País has never been accused or found, you know, kind of guilty of any kind of business like that. But it's interesting you say that, you know, that El País is left-wing, because that's one of the criticisms we probably come in for more often than not these days. El País is now right-wing. So it just all depends on who's talking and the way, you know, which way they're looking at it.
Because I get told not to mention Elvis and Derby County on my Facebook.
Because if not, that's all you talk about.
Well, exactly. I've interviewed many kind of incredible newspaper journalists from the UK and around the world over the years, and their job always seems so glamorous. You know, they'd be following somebody round for the story, and they'd go to various hotels around various exotic locations, and they'd be locked up with them for a week. You know, they'd get all the gossip from them. Nowadays, I guess all your research is internet based, is it?
Yeah, it's I should point out, you know, I'm not a reporter. I'm not someone that goes around, you know, reporting stories. No, exactly. Yeah, but there was a really interesting piece on Radio 4's media show recently about how so many newspapers, so many young journalists are getting completely disillusioned, because one of their main tasks is just literally to take a story from that's popped up on another website and just rewrite it and not do any kind of original reporting on it. Our section at El País, we've got this section called Verne, as in Jules Verne, and what they do is they do that kind of, it's a bit like the I-100 from The Independent. They do that stuff that's very much kind of internet based and looking at stuff that comes off the internet. But what they will do is they will then go and look up, they'll do some research and they'll do some reporting and they'll find out if that's true. I don't know if you saw last week this big controversy about this British girl girl, a blogger, fashion blogger, who tweeted that thing about her vegan meal in the Spanish restaurant. Yep. You see that? Yep. She was complaining, oh, vegan meal, they're giving me this. And it was like a plate of tomatoes and onions.
It went viral, yeah.
It went viral. Well, Verne, what they did was they actually rang up the restaurant, because on the plate, they could see the name of the restaurant. So they could tell which restaurant this girl was in. They rang up the restaurant and they said, well, you know, is this exactly what happened? They were like, well, no, that's not exactly what happened, actually. We offered her lots of different, you know, things. That's normally a side dish. We explained to her, you know, we're not a vegan restaurant. And that's what she asked for. And the girl ended up deleting her Twitter account, and she just completely disappeared off the internet, because I think she realized that she kind of put her foot in it.
Oh, lovely.
But it is a sad state of affairs that, you know, the thing, every online medium now has to have the same story. You know, everyone has to have that story just so they get the clicks. And a lot of people that have gone into journalism for, you know, noble reasons are coming up against these practices and just like, well, what's this? What are we doing this for?
Well, as we know, in the old days of good old print newspapers, everything in the newspapers was true.
Yeah, easy to believe it, isn't you?
And today, of course, we know that Elvis isn't dead. In fact, he was found on the moon.
Yeah. 40 years later.
He was on the moon. There he was.
And Freddie Starr did eat that hamster.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, we've run out of time. It's been fantastic. To meet you firstly, Simon, and indeed to catch up on your very interesting story, actually. I hope you have a lovely rest of your holiday.
Thanks ever so much, Bill.
We'll talk to you again down the line.
Yes.
I'm back with the cats coming in on the occasion.
And if you do ever want to come back for afternoons, we are still available.
Shall pop in with David.
We're going to start a bidding war now, are we?
This goes back to, just don't mention golf bags to Bill, because this goes back to a golf bag.
I'm very bitter about the golf bag story.
I outbid him on a charity auction for a golf bag, and it's still lingering.
Golf bag gate still is still big in my life. Cheers, Simon. Cheers, David.
Thanks,
see you
Bill.
Later this afternoon, Dave, and I will see you tomorrow morning.